Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Michael Morris. It was an uneventful weekend. Nothing terribly important or interesting happened except a bit of a regional war in the Middle East, but we'll touch on that towards the end. Let's start off with some local news, though, before we get to that. And one of the interesting things that's been in discussion in the past couple of weeks is where the government of national unity is currently at. So there's this opinion piece written by Pierre Deforce, where he laments essentially the current way that the GNU works. He wrote this opinion piece in News 24, which was published in News 24. He talks about how much more smoothly the budget was passed this year because the ANC, unlike the budget last year, decided that it needed to consult its coalition partners before pushing this thing forward. Rather than doing what it did last time, which was just sort of bulldoze through and assume that everyone would bend to its will. He talks about his own research into how the cabinet was actually working with the government of national unity, and this is what he said in his piece. Quote, "When I looked into the manner in which government managed the tabling of bills in parliament a few years ago as part of a larger research project, I got the impression that cabinet at times functioned like a loose confederation of independent departments, that with some important policy decision taken by individual ministers and not collectively by the cabinet. This is not how the Constitution envisages the executive to operate. In terms of Section 85 of the Constitution, the president exercises the executive authority together with other members of the cabinet, which means the power to determine the policies of government is vested collectively in the president and his cabinet, and not individual ministers. It is the cabinet that determines government policy, and individual ministers are collectively responsible for implementing these policies. This is partly why Section 92 of the Constitution makes it clear that members of the cabinet are collectively and individually accountable to Parliament for the exercise of their powers and performance of their functions." He goes on to say later in the piece, "But as far as the GNU is concerned, it is not always clear what exactly these policies and programs might be, who actually determines the specific aspects of these policies. For example, the Minister of Finance seemed to have moderated his belief that he is entitled to have a free hand in drafting the budget so long as he keeps the President on board and the ANC informed, but it is not clear as to what extent the budget is based on policies agreed by the GNU cabinet. Moreover, the President's advisors, along with the Minister of International Relations, not the coalition government through cabinet, seem to determine South Africa's foreign policy without this policy having been agreed upon by the GNU. He contrasts us with Germany, where he says that the Germans write up these very extensive coalition agreements when they have parties forming a government. And he says in South Africa, quote, "The coalition partners in the GNU came together with only a vague agreement on broad policy choices facing the new government. Moreover, in the otherwise vague and cryptic statement of intent agreed to by the ANC and DA and some smaller parties on the morning before Ramaphosa's election as president, coalition partners agreed the GNU shall take decisions in accordance with established practice of consensus. When no consensus is possible, the principle of sufficient consensus shall apply. Sufficient consensus requires parties representing at least 60% of the seats in the National Assembly, in effect the ANC and DA, to agree. But this system also creates problems. In the absence of clear GNU policies, individual ministers from different parties are likely to try and do their job, implementing the policy preferences of their own party. GNU ministers are collectively accountable for and bound by the policies of government they serve in and should resign if they are unable to implement these policies. But there are no agreed GNU policies. It gives individual ministers a lot of leeway to pursue the policy goals of their party." He goes on to say that other countries wouldn't stand for the state of affairs. Michael, reading through this, I think you and I both came to the same conclusion, which is that, yeah, you know, should government and cabinet be sort of working together? Should there be a kind of broad agreement on policy and all that sort of thing? In a perfect world, yes. But as far as things are, this really isn't that big of a problem. And in fact, in some ways, there's some big positives. As I said to you in our pre-show discussion, if cabinet all being on the same page just results in awful policy consensus being rammed through over the objections of so many South Africans, then it really doesn't seem to be much of a win for the country. The parties are just too far apart to agree on any kind of broad thing, and so this is the best we can do. I don't know. What's your take?
Yes, I absolutely agree. In fact, the phrase you used, I wrote it down because it's copyrightable. You said that if cozy consensus produces toxic policy, then it's really not worth it. And I think that's true. I think, you know, we don't want cozy consensus. We don't want placid and sort of inoffensive politics if it's going to undermine the vigor that we actually require. We've got very serious problems. We've got to tackle them with great energy. It's not going to happen if we just sort of go along quietly and cooperatively. Pierre de Force refers to other countries, says other countries wouldn't tolerate this. Well, that's absolutely fine. Let them do it their way. But South Africans, quite rightly, would not be well served by that cozy consensus that you rightly refer to. And, you know, the virtue here is that parties are challenged. The public is very attentive, watching all the parties, how they behave. The DA is already coming to quite a lot of flack from supporters saying, you know, why aren't you resisting BEE policy and the latest employment equity quota legislation, the Bella Bill, and so on, expropriation without compensation. This is all very positive stuff. We need public pressure on our political representatives to live up to the promises they've made, the positions they've set out, and we need to see that playing out in this quite difficult environment of coalition politics. I just the other day I saw somebody complaining that, you know, the GNU is not a marriage of convenience. It is a marriage of convenience rather than one of conviction. Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, the convenience is that you're in there with the hope of bending policy to your way of thinking. There's nothing convenient about it at all. These parties have either, yeah, you know, accepting the this, we're embracing it as a country. It's the if our votes are not sufficient, any given party's votes are not sufficient to enable it to run the show, it then has to negotiate with the other parties. And I think this is a very healthy thing. I mean, some of the points that Pierre de Force raises, I think in the past year or so, we've written various things about, you know, whether we need more rules about how coalitions work, whether there ought to be, he refers to a comprehensive coalition agreement. Maybe there's some virtue in that. But by the same token, we don't want it to be so constrained by procedure that we're unable to just do politics publicly. This is really what we need, what we
want. Despite the sort of lack of rules and the fact that the parties don't trust each other and all that, it's held together. Now, maybe it won't make a full 5 years, but that is still something quite interesting, because the main reason you draw up an agreement like that is to create stability. Well, we've sort of had, I wouldn't call it stability per se, but we've had something that, you know, keeps the government functioning, which is sort of good enough, I suppose.
Exactly, and I think it's borne upon the participants in the government, but also increasingly on the society, that we have a number of material urgent things that need doing, and we've got to try and find a way to do this. There's no sort of magical thing. There's nothing romantic about it. We've just got to try and find each other. We're all more or less on the same page. We want the country to be better. We want the country to work. We want success for our own parties and so on. There are just these here and there fundamental differences, which maybe I think I'm very certain are being gradually eroded by this very kind of public political process. People's, you know, I think the VAT issue in the last budget was a very, very important case for all the parties, and for the public. The public could see this playing out in the open. Here's the party that perhaps it was always thought of as belonging to some little sectarian racial group on the side and relevant to the national interest. Here it's speaking up and speaking a language that we can understand, that the masses can understand. And the party that was supposedly representing the masses now having to confront the fact that there's this a very rude contradiction in the impression that's been created, quite legitimately so. And it forged a completely different outcome. So I think it's a healthy thing. It is tricky, but certainly I think the public polling suggests the public has faith in this notion that South Africans can work together. They themselves are accustomed to this. This is everyday existence in South Africa. We all get on. There's no civil strife really of any note in this country. We're completely familiar with one another. We're also completely familiar with all the kind of romances and the shibboleths that go with identity politics in the country. And yet we overlook all these things. We manage to get on very well. So I think there is a desire among the public to see this kind of government work. And I think people would be probably quite distressed if it all became cozy, as you put it. I think that's a very good word to use. Too much politics, too much sort of cooperative self-denial and all that sort of thing. We want to see the real thing happening, and we want to be able to believe in it for that very reason.
So the exact reason I originally very publicly and aggressively suggested that the DA should not form a coalition with the ANC was I feared precisely that cozy agreement between the parties, that the DA would become sort of, slowly, warmly enveloped in a kind of velvet cage that would sort of destroy the identity of the party. And then we would have the only opposition parties we'd have left in the country would be the EFF and MK, which is not an ideal state of affairs if you believe in human flourishing and prosperity. So that was sort of my main fear about the formation of a coalition. And I've sort of made my peace with the GNU in the sense that I think that this each department kind of doing its own thing has actually kind of mitigated the potential damages of that arrangement. While the parties still have to make sort of compromises because they're sort of working across purposes sometimes, it does actually mean that they're sort of keeping their identities alive and that has stopped the sort of slide into a monolithic dysfunctional government. I think the DA has been very skillful at sort of walking the tightrope there. It's definitely irritated some people, as you mentioned at the beginning. But by and large, it does, based on polling that we've seen, mostly from the Common Sense Social Research Foundation, it seems to be working out for them. I will say that the other reason, of course, that this coalition is together, that this marriage of the sort of arranged marriage with no love lost between the participants is here, is because the participants know the alternatives are really dire. In the case of the ANC, they know that they'll have to cut in MK or the EFF into their systems, and also they would seriously damage faith in the markets that this wasn't anything like a serious government if they cut those parties into government with them. And the DA, campaigned on saying that they would stop a doomsday coalition. that has always made it a bit difficult for them to sort of get out of this arrangement because then they'd be bringing upon doomsday upon the country. So it's not a happy marriage, but for the sake of the country, it seems to be doing okay so far. Not that I think it's going to lift growth in the ways that are necessary, but considering some of the alternatives, it's far better, which is a reversal from what I used to believe. I think DeVos is pretty much wrong here. If we had one party controlling the government, or if we had a coalition of parties that were sort of broadly on the same wavelength, we could consider this. But, the parties making up the GNU, and it's not just the DA and ANC, of course, the smaller parties as well, vary enormously in their interests. And, some of them are very identity-based politics that want just one group to get something. Others are sort of ideologically very far from the DA and even from the ANC sometimes. So this is actually, I think, generally a tolerable state of affairs for now. Any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. And you know, if you think back to where, I mean, when was it formed? June 24. That's quite a long while ago, isn't it? It was June 24. You know,
although the cabinet, I think, was only announced in what, July or something.
So mid 24. And the fact that it's managed to survive this long, and there have been these few quite important indications of a different kind of politics. I think a lot of people are still, and we certainly among them, wanting to see more decisive positions on NHI, on expropriation, and on race-based policy. I don't need to underline the stress that we lay on that, the importance of that, and the importance of it actually chiefly as a way to get to really empowering South Africans and moving beyond our history. But the fact that the instrument has survived this long, I think, is quite telling. I'm quite surprised in a way that, you know, so late in the day, Pierre de Force has been writing an opinion which almost seems to be contradicted by the success of the GNU, or at least its longevity so far. You know, the fact that it's managed to endure. But anyway, I do think it's probably quite a useful debate to have. And just to remind ourselves that we, you know, we are in a very different kind of politics, and it's no longer that dead end politics of, you know, one dominant party being completely untrammeled in its activity, and facing no headwinds really to speak of. It's now really in having to, you know, to compete directly with people who say who have very different, completely opposite politics and opposite policies. So that's a fundamentally useful thing. And working with them at the same time, that's a very useful thing.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to our next story. Our colleague Terence Corrigan has written a piece about South Africa's water crisis, looking at this kind of in the broader scope. Obviously, we know that there are many different municipalities around the country that have been having water problems. Probably the most critical right now is Johannesburg, where the water problems sort of are endless, but mostly kind of localized in a suburb for a while, and then they sort of move to the next suburb. Some suburbs are hit worse than others, like I know Melville and Rivoli and Westbury and places like that are quite often some of the worst hit. But the water crisis is much larger than that. And as our colleague Terence argues, this is not just some sort of, you know, it's not the same as electricity. It's not the same as, it's not really driven by natural circumstances. It's sort of a much broader failure. So I'm going to quote a bit from Terence's piece here. Quote, dry taps sometimes lasting for days or weeks or months are now a fact of life for South Africans. On the face of it, South Africa's water supply failures could seem like just any other of a long list of crises afflicting the country. In a familiar pattern, public frustration is met with a mix of official hubris and bombast, which is in turn repaid with public cynicism. This has been the case with crime, corruption, and collapsing municipal governance, and was for years the case with South Africa's electricity supply. The water crisis is, however, different. Water was a deeply evocative political issue during the transition. It's a life-giving element, something which each person needs. In 1994, it was estimated that some 16 million South Africans lacked access to potable water. Ensuring that each person had what they so fundamentally needed would be emblematic of the superior morality of our new society, bringing about this mandate that the African National Congress assumed for itself. Was what the African National Congress assumed for itself. He goes on to talk about how this was included in the Constitution as a right, but that right is not being fulfilled. Last year, this is from Terence's piece again, in a presentation to Parliament, the Department of Water and Sanitation conceded the quality of drinking water in South Africa has deteriorated significantly, with the percentage of water supply systems failing microbiological safety standards increasing from 5% in 2014 to 46% in 2023. This decline posed a serious health risk, heightening the likelihood of waterborne diseases such as cholera and chronic diarrhea. This is the background, not an act of nature. However much South Africa faces a hard climate, which threatens to become ever more unforgiving, but one shaped by choices and failure, or an inability to live up the expensive promises that have been made at the country's democratic dawn. As the late John Kane Berman, former CEO of the Institute of Race Relations, remarked in a 2020 commentary, the country's major problem is less a shortage of water than the manner which its admittedly limited supply of water are managed, or rather mismanaged. Like our electricity crisis, our water crisis is man-made. Terence says that one of the upshots of this governance failure is essentially that the entire constitution can, in a sense, be discredited, because after all, the government is violating our constitutional rights to having access to clean, safe drinking water. And if they can violate that right, well, you kind of begin to wonder what other rights can also just be ignored. Michael, what do you make of this one? It is one of the reasons why this is a very old argument from us in South Africa, going to before my time, or I guess technically I was alive, I was born in 93, as to what the Constitution should look like. But it is indeed important. Our Constitution does promise this, and it is not being fulfilled, increasingly so. What's your take?
Yes, I think, I mean, just to reinforce that final paragraph in Terence's piece, he says the question is whether the country can recover. So he's talking, you know, the water crisis is one thing, but can the country recover? And he goes on to say the IRR warned when the constitution was written, that was in 1996, it was formally ratified, warned when the constitution was written that including socioeconomic rights would create the risk of discrediting the whole order if they could not be delivered. And this is really why, you know, water is so fundamentally important today. This kind of failure is implicitly saying the project has failed. We have failed to meet the basic promise that we made back in 1996, 30 years ago, in December, it'll be exactly 30 years ago that the Constitution was signed. That we are transforming, we are creating a society for everybody, where everybody is going to have access, as you said, citing Terence, this life-giving element of society, water, very fundamental thing. The promise was this is going to be, it's a right that everyone has, and we get to deliver it. And then you contrast that with what's happening in 2026, and it's absolutely horrific. So it is, yeah, it's a very serious thing. It's much, as you say, that much more important than electricity in its conceptual sense. I mean, electricity is absolutely vital for economic growth and all the rest of it. But here's something, you know, that cuts right to the promise of the entire order, and I think it does raise that very serious question. So it's going to, you know, we're going to have to see the story that you shared earlier from Ground Up highlights the fact that Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana announced in the budget that 27.7 billion. Was being allocated to Johannesburg Water alone over the next 3 years. So this gives some sense of the scale of the problems. 48% of Joburg's water is lost to leaks, bursts, and illegal connections. I mean, this is a seriously chronic situation. I saw somebody commenting on the Daily Friend comment section a bit earlier about how nobody is talking about the fact that Cape Town is the exception, because here things are, I mean, it's completely unheard of. In Cape Town to have your water cut off, except actually in the Morris household, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, where suddenly we woke up one morning and nothing came out of the taps, and we phoned the city in a state of panic and anger to be told that we'd actually forgotten to pay to pay our outstanding bill. And the city was completely and utterly egalitarian in its application of punitive measures under these circumstances. And unfortunately, we would have to wait 24 hours or 48 hours or whatever it was to have the water restored. And once we had paid our overdue bill. So that, you know, that's how a city ought to work. And discomforting though it personally was, inwardly, I also cheered at the idea of a city doing its job. So it's, you know, it's possible. It's not rocket science, as I've often said, to run a city properly, but it does require all the things that Terence highlights. You can't get rid of experts. You've got to keep the maintenance up. You've got to do the thing properly. It's one thing to promise a constitutional right. You've actually got to live up to it with the humdrum, daily, prosaic business of doing the job properly.
And
so that's it.
It's not just a municipal problem. It's not just a national problem. It's sort of at kind of multiple layers. This is one of the reasons why it's such a big problem, is that you need, firstly, things like the Lesotho Highland Water Project should have been, you know, much further along, much better managed, all these sort of things. But then also government should have the next water project in mind already. There's, you know, some questions as to whether that much more water can be gotten out of Lesotho and the Orange River system. Maybe Gauteng is going to need other things. I know that the Cape is currently worried, Cape Town is worried that there's going to be possibly a drought. They're still sort of unsure, but they're asking people to not use that much water at the moment. So, you know, we have difficult water conditions in this country. It's true, we are a pretty dry country, but that doesn't mean that the problem isn't due to mismanagement. That means that we need to plan ahead, make lots of investments, and reduce wastage. Now, when you reduce wastage and do all the things sort of right at the lower levels, you can mitigate the upper problems more. But this problem is not going to be solved, I think, until National seriously reconsiders its water spending. So hopefully the spending by Treasury makes its way to where it needs to go. Of course, that's the other problem, is that it's good that they've allocated money to fix these problems. They're very serious problems that need urgent attention. But as we've seen so often, just because you put the money there doesn't mean it gets to where it's supposed to go. So that's the next phase of where I think people should be ensuring accountability. Okay, let's move on to our last topic. So, you know, we tend to not talk too much about foreign affairs unless it involves South Africa very directly. But this one's pretty big. On Saturday night? I've already, days have all sort of blurred together in my mind, so I apologize. I think it was Saturday night. The United States and Israel carried out a series of large airstrikes across Iran. Very quickly, it appears as though they have killed a significant proportion of the leadership of the Iranian Islamic Republic, most notably Supreme Leader of Iran, Khamenei, who was killed in an airstrike. I think it was on his Supreme Leader's palace. And to that, I must take a sort of moment to say that I'm kind of fairly pleased that such an unpleasant character has gotten his comeuppance. Khamenei only just recently was behind ordering his security forces to kill, we don't know exactly how many, but could well be tens of thousands of his own people protesting against his regime. Nasty piece of work. Been behind all sorts of nasty things across the Middle East for a long time. That being said, this is now sort of turning a bit to a bit of a regional war. While the ostensive reason that the US launched this attack was to prevent Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon, which they claimed was imminent, there's a bit of confusion, I think, as to where things go from here. The Iranians have hit back by targeting US military assets across the region, by targeting civilian assets in Qatar, in the UAE, in Saudi Arabia. Hotels have been hit in Dubai and Bahrain as well. I think Oman has had some stuff damaged. There's increasingly few ships traveling through the important Strait of Hormuz, which is the sea between the UAE and Iran, which carries, I think it's about 20% of the world's oil. Israel has also been hit by Iranian missiles, first retaliation for this. And so far, the Iranian government, although much of its leadership has been wiped out in these strikes, seems to continue to be striking U.S. and Israeli targets. And the U.S. and Israel have also continued to strike targets in Iran. It's very difficult to know what exactly is going on. There's just huge amounts of stuff being churned out on social media. And at the same time, Iran has switched off its internet, so getting information from inside Iran on the general, on the sort of casual web internet is not so easy. For me, there's some aspects of the story. South Africa seems to be deciding to unwisely try and get involved in this one. There's some discussion that we're going to, along with Colombia and the Hague group, call for an emergency meeting on accountability and the enforcement of international law in the Hague, which I presume is targeted at the US, which seems like it's not going to really do anything to change things except irritate the Americans and Israelis more. So I'm not really sure on a practical point of view how much that benefits us. There's also some questions about to whether the Department of International Relations and Cooperation properly warned South Africans and is properly looking after them, many of whom are stranded in the conflict zone at the moment. It's been huge disruptions of flights. Anyone flying through Doha or Dubai has had their flights messed with. For me, the sort of overall point, though, apart from all of that, is that I think there's going to be a temptation from a lot of analysts to sort of forecast what this means or how this proves that, you know, Trump is the great decisive leader, or how this proves that America is Satan and just destroys everything and this will end the Trump presidency. There'll be many very bold predictions made and already being made in the next few days. I think, unfortunately, the unsatisfying answer is it's very difficult to know what happens next. I think this is a time of profound chaos where a lot of the details available to the public are rather thin. So it's going to take us a while to exactly work out what the consequences of all of this will be. In the short term, though, I guess higher oil prices, disrupted flights, and all that sort of thing. Michael, what's your take on all this?
The phrase that immediately comes to mind is one that I think I mentioned before, that Terence, our colleague, Terence Corrigan, is fond of, that there are many moving parts in the story. And I think that's absolutely true. But all of them actually illustrating exactly what you've just said is that, you know, there's so little we can be certain of. I personally have misgivings about the idea of the concept of regime change or of powerful states intervening to produce what they think might be a better outcome, without recognizing perhaps that the historical process is a vastly, vastly complex one. There's so many thousands and thousands of variables. You take out, you know, a single individual, remove this person, neutralize them, kill them, to use plain English, in the hope that this is going to trigger something positive. I think it's completely impossible to predict what's likely to happen next. There's all sorts of power play just within the circle around, the surviving circle around Khamenei. And never mind the people who Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu might imagine they were speaking to when they said, come on, Iran, rise up and take charge. You know, history just doesn't work that way. It's almost childish to say these sorts of things. You imagine, I mean, you know, the obvious sort of example for me would be if you imagined in October 1989, if America and Britain had just suddenly decided they'd had enough with apartheid and they came in here and they assassinated P.W. Botha and they whipped Nelson Mandela out of Robben Island and put him in Parliament and said, you now in charge, and you, this is the provisional, you know, the kind of provisional authority in South Africa, and this is what we desire, it's what everybody wants. Well, it's just not as easy as that. I mean, it took 4 years. And four of the bloodiest years in more than a decade in South Africa to produce an agreement that most people more or less could live with, and which, you know, serves us today in one fashion or another. And even now, we're contending with, we've just spoken about one of the issues, you know, the idea of socioeconomic rights being written into that constitution. That it was in that period that it happened, and after 4 years of deliberation. But it, you know, you imagine if we hadn't had those negotiations, all those torturous processes that went on over that time. If instead somebody had stepped in and said, well, look, you know, we know what the answer is here. These guys are bad. Let's get rid of them and let's put the good guys in charge. It would have been, a delusion that you could just shortcut history in that way. History simply doesn't work like that. But I remain doubtful. I mean, I think, you know, at a primal level, I think the idea of removing people who caused terrible death and destruction and mayhem and who seem to be so uncaring about their own citizens, you know, you can't help thinking, well, surely this is better than just tolerating their being there and doing what they're doing. So it is, yeah. It's a morally and intellectually quite challenging circumstance where, you know, you, as you say, I think you're quite right. The most honest thing is to say we don't really know how things are going to play out from here, and you know, we can spectate in a sense and try to make sense of it.
Yeah. So this is a debate you and I have had off camera, off screen. I guess we've been on screen most of the time we've had this debate, but anyway, not on air, about, you know, what is regime change, whether it can work, whether it's a thing. I tend to be much warmer to the idea that, you know, even though things are difficult and even though historical processes are complicated, that sometimes you just have to do something, you have to act, and that inaction of it can be a mistake as well, particularly with a regime as awful as the Iranian regime, which is, we're already over time, so we really don't have time to get into it. But, you know, there's a lot of reasons. Yeah. This conflict was not born last week. It was not born when the Trump administration came into power. This is a very long, long running conflict that stretches at least back to 1979, if not further. In a way, this is a culmination of a very long arc of conflict in around Iran. But I think the part I do agree with you on is that this is kind of complicated stuff, and you know, I think we're going to, you know, as I said, we sort of have to wait and see where things are going from here, because I don't think whatever happens, it's not going to be a neat story. It's going to be a messy story, and I hope that Iran, at the end of all of this, becomes a democratic and free nation that respects its citizens, that seeks to live in harmony with its neighbors, you know, all of those good things come about. We don't know if that's going to happen, though. And there are many alternative scenarios which also could emerge. So definitely something to keep an eye on. But, you know, this is also, I think, part of a broader pattern in the world of a kind of, I'm not going to say an unraveling, but a shakeup of how things were. We certainly soon seem to be living through times where change is happening quite rapidly. To what end, I think it's very unclear. But, you know, this is probably not the last major conflict we've seen in the world in the next couple of years. I would not be surprised if there are more to come, unfortunately. With all that said, any final thoughts before we finish for today?
I think just really to underline that uncertainty, that if one is intellectually and morally honest, I think, you know, uncertainty is the position to cleave to, and really just to feel one's way from there. The risk, it always seems to me, is when people become absolutely certain, they say, yes, this is absolutely right. That's always when humanity makes terrible mistakes. But it's difficult. It's difficult.
Anyway, with that, we hope you found today's show interesting. We will, of course, be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a most excellent day. Bye-bye.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.